I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome back to In the Pink with me, Natalie Pinkham. Amy Fuller is certainly a little ball of energy, isn't she? She's great fun to be around, lovely to talk to. I hope you enjoyed her podcast. Thank you for the feedback so far. And remember that we are giving away some Bose 700s, the noise-cancelling headphones. All you have to do is rate, review and subscribe. Leave us a comment about the podcast, maybe who you want us to interview next. And you are in with a chance of winning those very cool headphones, which is just a lovely little present for Christmas, isn't it? Okay, my next guest. Well, I'm actually continuing the theme of strong, athletic women, inspiring women. And growing up, this lady was a massive hero of mine. In fact, she hasn't stopped being. She's just wonderful. I'm talking about Kelly Holmes, a fairy tale story, winning double Olympic gold at the age of 34. 34! To win double Olympic gold, that's bonkers. And she did it with the backdrop of some terrible injuries. I mean, the tenacity and mental fortitude required to come back from those injuries and perform at that level is quite incredible. But you should know that actually underpinning all of that is a story that is both heartbreaking and inspiring. I mean, massively heartbreaking. I never knew that there was so much sorrow in Kelly Holmes's life, and she touches on some very sensitive areas which some of you may find upsetting. And if anything that we discuss does affect you and you need to reach out, then please do call the Samaritan helpline. They are available any time of day or night, and the number is 116 123. Also give us your feedback. You know, I read through all your comments, and I know that Kelly is on a mission to support people through the difficult times, and she does so by opening up and being honest and candid about her own struggles. So here she is, Kelly Holmes, in her own words. Well, this is a lovely little space in sunny Kent, isn't it?
I know.
Nice little oasis of calm in what's a crazy busy life for you, Kelly.
It is. I love coming back to Hillenburgh. So I've born and bred in Hillenburgh. In fact, I was born down in the council estate, just down the road from where we're sitting. And I like that mix that I have, you know, kind of the quiet, hear the birds normally, and then the hustle and bustle of life, which is planes, trains, anything else.
So this is your place to escape?
Yeah, so where we're actually sitting now is in it's called the 1809 Hub. There's a little story behind this place. So when I was 13, I was a paper-round girl in the original sweet shop that stood on this plot, and then I worked behind the till. And then I said to the guy, I'm going to buy this place one day. And I had no idea why. It was just an old sweet shop. But what I remember was, like, at Christmas and Easter in particular, they used to do these wonderful window displays, and everything looked just so good. And everyone used to come in. It used to be like a real central hub for people, the community, because I've lived here all my life, born just at the hospital down the road. And I just remember all these things when I was a kid, like, oh, so nice, everyone comes in. So anyway, during my athletics and army career, I tried to buy it. When for 15 odd years I was having this thing with this guy, and I was like, oh, I'm never going to get it. And he was saying, oh, all this stupid money. By the time I eventually got it. It was derelict building. And I'd threatened literally the estate agents up the row. I said, have you ever sell it to someone else? You know what I mean? I'm hunting you down, because she knew I wanted it. Anyway, she calls me and says,
that's probably what drove up the price.
I know, right? Yeah, no. Well, no, because he unfortunately, Ben passed away. So that's why it came up for sale. Oh. I then got it. It was a shack, walls, everything falling down. Went through a big old thing about planning permission. Anyway, eventually I got it. Took a year to build it into what was then made into a coffee house called Cafe 1809. 1809 is after my Athens running number, hence that.
Love it.
Opened the cafe for 4 years, then thought, oh God, this is hard. It's just hard. No, it's just, I did what I wanted to do, but it wasn't really what my future was, if you know what I mean. It was almost because I wanted to do it for so many years, I thought I have to. I'm not a person that lives with regret.
I was going
to
say, this story just about sums you up. You definitely set your mind on something and achieve it. It might take a bit longer than you think, but you get there in the end.
Always. Yeah, I think that's part of life generally, you know, kind of set yourself a goal. You never know what's going to happen, but I hate that. I've never wanted the if only feeling, which is like the too late, because you can't get too late back, you know, in any walk of life and whatever you do. And so I thought, well, I wanted to do it. I've done it. It was a big learning curve. It's part of the story that I have to this day. And so, yeah. And I think I do that with, yeah, most things. You know, I set myself a goal. Like when I started my charity in 2008, I had no idea how you set up a charity. I mean, how do you set up a charity?
Bloody
really?
Hard.
It's really hard,
actually,
right?
Isn't
yeah.
It?
So
I've done it.
I had nowhere
tough.
To go, as in like an office. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I wanted to work with disadvantaged kids, areas of deprivation. I wanted to work with retiring sports people. Came up with this idea, and you know, first office was sitting on somebody's floor in a old cupboard in this insurance building in London. And 12 years down the line,
amazing.
We've helped 300,000 young people and transitioned over 700 athletes into new careers. So,
wow.
Yeah, but it's just
God.
Having a passion. I think passion.
Yeah.
I think most things for me start with a passion and then a goal. And then it's like you can give up really easy or you can try and do it. And when you try and do it, you learn a lot. And if you don't, it's if only. And sometimes you shouldn't have done it because you've spent too much time, effort, money, tears. But I'd rather have that than...
Rather have tried.
Yeah.
Right, now we have a chance to win, and win big, because you have the opportunity to walk away with a pair of Bose noise-cancelling headphones, the 700 series, worth around £350. Wouldn't that be lovely just before Christmas? All you have to do is rate, review and subscribe. Leave us a review on the In The Pink podcast, on Apple Podcasts and on our Instagram page. We will pick one. Doesn't have to be sycophantic, but that always helps. Make us laugh. Give us some feedback on any of our guests, and we will pick someone to walk away with those headphones.
Do you know, I'm going to do an early doors confession that I absolutely love athletics above and beyond any other sport.
Oh, wow.
Now, I've worked in Formula One a long time. I've always loved Formula One. I love rugby, I love football, I love tennis. There's actually no sport I won't watch, but athletics for me was just the ultimate. And massive fan of yours. Before you, Zola Budd was just like, I mean, my earliest memory of any sporting occasion was 84 Olympics when she ran barefoot. And I remember probably only being, well, very little girl at the time. And not understanding what happened with her and Decca Slaney.
Oh, yes.
And my dad explaining it to me that life wasn't always fair, but you've got to get back up and all of this. But for me, the enduring image of you coming over that finishing line with your eyes almost popping out of your head,
yeah.
With your arms aloft, pumping the air, that's going to stay with me forever. And I'm sure it will hundreds of thousands of your fans around the world. Were you as surprised in that moment that your face suggested? Because
yes,
it was crazy. 34 years old to be double Olympic champion.
Yeah.
Did you think the time wouldn't ever come?
No, I always believed I could be Olympic champion since I was 14. I do not know why it was so embedded in my head and my heart. I just always believed it. And when I won the 800 metres, the one where my eyes were popping out of my head, I never expected to win the 800. I never did, even at that stage.
Well, it was fairly late in the day you deciding to even do it, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I'd had a 12-year international career. I'd won, prior to the Olympics, 12 international medals, 5 at 800 and 5 at 15. And so what happened was is In 2004, it was the first year in seven that I hadn't been injured. So everything really went well for me. Consistency of training, you know, really increased my self-esteem back, my confidence back, had a great team around me, and I was just flying and training. And it was almost come to that realisation that it's probably going to be my last Olympics, it was my third anyway, that I was in the shape of my life. And if I came back for two medals, any colour, what a great end to a year. And I really believe I could medal at the Games because my time suggested it, and I was really, really confident in my ability.
And you'd medalled in Sydney.
I'd medalled in Sydney, 800 metres. I'd gone fourth in 96, running with a stress fracture. You know, so I'd done loads of things. So I always knew I could do it, but it was that real confirmation that year that it's all going really well. I can only mess it up, really. And obviously my body could have, but my team were brilliant. And so when I did the 800, when I crossed the line, I'll tell you what, because I play it. I do motivational speaking now on stage. And I always play this because everyone loves the little montage, don't they? And it is that thing where I literally won by thickness of, let's say somebody's wearing a shirt or T-shirt, 0.05 of a second separated the first four of us. That's how close it was. But that side of a win is all right, isn't it? Because when you come fourth and you lose by that much, it can sucks. And I've come fourth at one of the Olympics before by less than a tenth of a second.
I mean, it's crazy. That's like Formula One margins.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just minuscule, isn't it?
Yeah, just that bit is a difference between complete glory Olympic champion and being an also run in fourth, you know, so when I crossed the line, though, this is the thing, I crossed the line and I started to celebrate, and this is what people see on my little video, but then I suddenly thought to myself, oh my God, I couldn't have won, you know, it's like this thing, oh, and I thought I was celebrating prematurely, and I'm like, bring my arms out, like, ah, oh, you know, kind of like the face is coming down, thinking, oh God, what's happened, and I'm looking on the inside of this track, and the British photographer's jumping up and down like a madman, he's going, Kelly, you've won, and I reacted, and I won. I met him 3 months later, he said, Kelly, best night of my life ever. Also the worst, didn't get one bloody photo of you. And he was a British photographer, you know, jumping mad for his cameras.
Because he was so swept away by the moment.
Exactly.
Oh, that's lovely, but, though.
Yeah.
It?
So that was, just something that I crossed the line and I just like, wow, I just could not believe it. Because it's a moment, you know, that took me 20 years of dreaming. That wasn't just the athletics career. I dreamt of winning a gold medal, not that one, hence why I went for the 15, for 20 years. I'd always believed I could get it.
But actually, your dream started relatively late because you only sort of really thought about this, as you say, when you were about 14 years old. And then I'm not saying you digressed, but you went and had a career in the army. But you never gave up that dream? Was it always just gnawing at the back of your mind that this is something you needed to do?
Yeah, so having been inspired by those Olympic Games, the 84 Olympic Games as well, watching Sebastian Coe, I did.
Okay,
so I watched him win the 1500 for Great Britain, and obviously I was still kind of really intrigued by Mary Decker Slaney and Zola Budd, but they were running the 3000. It wasn't my distance, so it was kind of like not as attached, I suppose. And then
I just love the fact she didn't wear shoes.
I know.
I just love
that. She held our British records for years. I broke the 1500 record in 97. It stood for 12 years by her. And she was like a 16-year-old in no shoes. I mean, amazing.
Bonkers.
Amazing. So it was definitely a dream, a fluffy cloud. When I was 17, I won the Mini Youth Olympics in Holland. I won the 800 metres, gold medal around my neck, national anthem playing, British flag flying, and I had that moment back then of like, I wonder if it ever come true when I grew up. But I also had, at that stage, another ambition when I was 14 to go into the military. Mm. So I joined the military a month before I was 18 and had 10 years there. But during that career, I sort of got back into my running. No one knew I was a runner when I first joined the army. I just kept beating all the guys. So it was kind of become evident, you know. And then I watched the Olympic Games again. And it was always the Olympic movement, that kind of sense of enormity and just, you know, that Olympic rings and the passion is just something you don't get anywhere else, do you? You know, and so I watched them when I was 22, and this time I'm in the army in my barrack room watching the games. You know, a girl that was running that I used to run against in Kent and beat, and she's there, and I'm in the army, like, ah. And it just reignited the passion, I think. So I kind of half-heartedly got back into running, but literally 6 months after I started running, I was at like a world championships in Stuttgart, and then following year I'm winning like Commonwealth Games gold and European silver, just like, you know, literally like a click of the fingers. But I'm still a full-time army soldier because I used to use my leave to go away. So it's kind of that connection with reality, as in that was my job, my career, but I was so strong as a female. Always so strong, because I had to be to push against guys, you know, when you're in charge of 500 600 guys fitness levels to potentially go out on the front line, you have to be quite serious in that.
That's amazing. Great grounding for a career in
and
any
a
kind
young
of professional
person,
sport,
to be honest, you know. Joining before I was 18, it really taught me to grow up, you know. I left home and to iron, interact with people, communicate for people all over the world, rules, regulations, discipline. And obviously you need that for being a good athlete as well.
Yeah, and yeah, you clearly excelled in that framework. Discipline was something that you were able to sort of feed off and use as a launch pad, if you like, for success.
I think so, yeah, because when I first come back into international athletics, or let's say civilian athletics, running for I think it was Kent at the time, in the UK Championship. So I'd been in the Army Championships, and the Army had actually said to me, do I want to go to this UK Champs? And I was like, oh, yeah. Didn't know anyone. Got announced as Corporal Holmes, and, you know, no one knew me at this time, apart from people that sort of thought, oh, wasn't she the girl that used to run years and years and years ago?
And she's that kid that used to hang out in the sweet shop.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Eating them all. I blame that for my sweet tooth to this day.
Yeah.
And I remember running these UK championships, and I won, and I qualified for the world champs, like literally. And I was like, how did I do that?
That's,
you know,
amazing.
It's so weird. But I think I was so strong, and I think that's the difference possibly of how my career became such a long one. And I was older because in my early 20s I was physically so strong as a female, because, you know, I'm running around in boots and combats and heavy weight and weapons and climbing up walls and swinging on ropes.
In the Pink is sponsored by Bose, who've been perfecting the art of sound so that you can listen in unrivaled comfort. The new Bose noise cancelling 700s take it to a whole other level, so you'll always hear exactly what you want, no matter where you are. Also, be heard like never before with their unrivaled 4-microphone system, which isolates your voice whilst cancelling the noise around you. Pretty cool, huh? Always stay connected with Bose's first-of-its-kind augmented reality function that will change the way you think about travel, exercise and learning. And never be caught out, because they have an excellent 20 hours of battery life. They come in black and silver, so you can work them around your style, your little fashionistas. And you can treat your ears with the Bose noise-cancelling 700s. It's a sound experience like no other. Now, back to the interview.
I do also think, like, and I'm sure that you come across a lot of these people with the work you do, motivational speaking, that so many people can achieve so much later than is necessarily perceived in life. You know, and I'm thinking that as long as you, nothing physically precludes you from doing that, which it clearly didn't, then you're in a better space mentally often to take on that challenge when you're a little bit older and wiser.
Well, I think now, so now post, I've been retired, 14 years now, and a lot of my work or interaction with people is at an event like parkrun or something. You know, I just rock up at a parkrun, kind of love it, you know, people are surprised I'm there, I do a little chat and then just run. But I've met so many people over these years because of sort of the fitness industry and lifestyle, who have started their careers into sport late 40s, early 50s.
Brilliant.
Who have totally transformed their life. They said they hated PE at school, never did anything in their 20s. At 30s, they were busy. And now they think it's more about health, social interaction, stop of isolation, and definitely their mental health and well-being, which I'm a massive advocate for.
Yeah, and it's something that you've been very open about. Now, when I first sort of learned of your struggles, because you talked about this for quite a long time, which is great, but I've sensed a progression in you and how much you've opened up over the years and the confidence with which you've spoken about it. Do you think that's because of the change of the landscape and that it's just much more open now and people and much more accepted and encouraged, and the feedback you then get from other people that you've helped them and that in turn helps you? I sense a change in you the more you've talked about it and the more reaction you've had to what's gone on?
Yeah, definitely. I think because I started talking about when I first wrote my autobiography in 2005, it was not a subject that people would talk about, mental health.
You're a trailblazer in that respect. Because, we're going back nearly 15 years.
Yeah, and people forget that because, of course, people weren't really aware or interested in it, to be honest with you. You know, when you're on the front of the newspapers talking about self-harming, and it becomes like a conversation you don't really have a conversation about.
Well, because you think people were just uncomfortable about talking about it.
I think it just wasn't really out there to people to start to go, well, how do you then talk about it and communicate back to me, let's say, about it? And also, the landscape has a lot to do with it. You know, our acceptance of conversation, our trying to stop stigmatism, trying to normalise in conversation, which is what I try to do when I talk and speak on stage, and humanising society again to make, you know, we're all just human. And when I wrote it in my book, it was a big deal to write in my book because I hadn't told anyone what I was going through, what struggles I'd had. And to open up was more about the fact that I wanted people to see that by winning my 2 gold medals, I'm not a superhuman. I'm not this person that flew down in a cape and suddenly was able to run. Because actually the perceived thing on sport is that you're also brilliant and, you know, cut above the rest. And that wasn't actually true. I was just a dedicated, talented athlete that refused to give up.
Yeah, but do you know what? Interestingly, when I read about it, it didn't surprise me that you'd had this adversity because I think you just learned how to channel it. And I think actually some of the greats need that back against the wall to come out fighting. You know, if it's all on a plate for you, it isn't as easy to achieve.
No. Like
you look at some of the great sports people that through our time, they've often come through very difficult, troubled childhoods. They've had, you know, pain, bereavement, whatever it is. And they've just been able to leverage that.
Yeah, I think in sport, it gives you that ability to push yourself and to stay in the zone, to be focused on what you want to get, and that's your goal. So everything else around it could become almost insignificant because actually all the pressures and the, you know, maybe the tears you have are all about just performance and wanting to get somewhere. And I think maybe you also then, you know, I could say that it was all about my athletics, but maybe it could have been about other things that, you know, are there, which have just not become prevalent or I didn't really want to think about or talk about or whatever. But the outlet for my pressure of just wanting to scream, like, because it was just hating everything about yourself and who you are and what you're doing and the pressures and not being able to talk about things or not whatever, just all came out. And you, when you have a breakdown, it's not something that you plan and it's not something that you maybe even know you're going to have. But if you look back, especially if I look at athletics wise, you know, the tears that I'd cried on the bed in pain and the disappointment of something that's gone wrong at the time when actually I could be like world number one, yet you get an injury, you know, and highs and lows. So I had 7 years out of my 12, I had injuries, you know, ruptured calves, torn Achilles, had damaged the femoral nerve in my back, muscle and cessation in the leg, glandular fever, tonsillitis, had three operations on my stomach at the time, female stuff. No one knew about any of that because you just get on with it. And you're only your team that are fixing you. But they never really ever, I never had a conversation where somebody was saying, how are you? How do you feel that this is all potentially going wrong? You know, I had that dream. It was a massive dream in my head, like, what will I do if this does never happen? So it's that emotional, psychological impact that I think just goes and carries on. And then for me, it came out in self-harming and breakdown. And at the end, but also part of what I talk about is that going through that struggle should never define you either. You know, when I was at the worst of my life, I was still getting ready for world championships. I still won a silver medal.
You went out and performed like 2 weeks after harming, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I was still in the mix of doing it.
That's crazy.
I was still in the mix of the worst time of my life.
Unbelievable strength.
But I always say, like on stage, like when half of you's almost dying because I literally didn't want to see the next day and half of you is living, that's the biggest battle, but also the strongest battle because that's what's keeping me going.
So did you have suicidal thoughts at the time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I wanted to open up the road and jump in it and not get back out or open up the bathroom floor. I was in, you know, I was screaming inside in a bathroom when I first started doing it, and I've got my training partner outside and my, you know, kind of my coach outside. Yeah, I can't scream because I didn't want them to know. Didn't want to put negative energy on them, so you're screaming inside, and my outlet was self-harming. But, you know, again, what I say to people, you can't get over those moments. So I haven't now become cured of mental health problems. Mm. Because I think once you've had something really bad, it's all, you're always perceptive of it, but you learn to deal and manage. Mm. So I manage.
Well, all a work in progress, aren't we? No one's perfect. Always, right? You're constantly constant. Managing. Yeah. Obviously, the injuries were constant setbacks and challenges that you had to overcome, which obviously would potentially undermine your confidence. But do you think it's all pinned back in your childhood, potentially? Do you think that actually... I mean, the reason I say this is because I do a lot of work with kids that have been separated from their mums at birth, very young in childhood. And they talk about Nancy... I was going to say Nancy Kerrigan. She's the she's the ice skater.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Nancy... I'll get her surname. She's written a book called The Primal Wound.
Right.
And it talks about how difficult it is for a baby to be separated from their biological mother and how that can manifest itself in massive depression, anxiety, all sorts of emotional issues, maybe issues with relationships further down the line, whether they be in sport or business or personal relationships. Yeah. Do you think this is where it could come back to?
I definitely think there's a prevalence in that, in terms of I was always wanting to be accepted, find my identity, and sport gave me that ability to be somebody, you know. So my mum had me when she was 17 to a Jamaican guy, who I don't know him, but to a Jamaican guy.
Did you ever get to know him?
Yeah, I met him once when I was 16 and found out I had a brother and sister as well that lived 5 miles up the road.
No.
Yeah, he lived... Pretty 5 miles up the road.
Do they still
all my
be
life.
5 miles up the road?
Yeah, I know. My sister and my brother were really close there.
That's amazing.
I met her in a supermarket. I was 16 and she was 14. She was with her mum. I was with my mum, and it was this little girl looking at me. She knew that she had a sister and about me, and I didn't know about her.
But did you look into each other's eyes and have some kind of connection?
I just thought, who's this? Because I heard my name. This woman saying, "Oh, that's Kelly," and then. I went home and I said to my mum, "Who's those in the supermarket?" So my mum was talking to this woman, and she wouldn't tell me. Went to her, I said, "Who are they?" And they knew my name, and she said, "Oh, that's your sister." And so mum, and then obviously I found over the years that I got to know the story a bit more. But yeah, so that was weird. But it was
so
more.
How do you feel about your dad now?
Oh, I'm not interested. My dad's stepdad, who's brought me up since I'm 5. He's my dad, Mick.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I don't need to know him. You know, for me, it's like your parent is. Somebody that cares, loves, and wants thing, and that parent can have any title, can have any name.
I totally agree.
It's that person that's thing. So no, I have no interest at all.
Is there any part of you though that thinks it's that whole kind of nature nurture thing? Is there any part of you genetically that you think might have come from your biological dad that intrigues you?
No, I'm not intrigued by him at all. No. I don't think, because I feel like it's always going to be a sort of, you know, my mum's British white, so it's always going to be some genetic thing that's possibly come from him. But I think also when you're good at something, so I could have been really good at running, but if I didn't have that perseverance, the attitude, the behaviour, the willingness to fight, that confidence, that doesn't come through that. That's you as an individual who I feel very privileged that I had that in me.
Yeah, but I think it's also your reaction to a very difficult situation.
Well, I think I was more like, so when I went to school, I felt like I didn't really have an identity. You know, I grew up in Whiteson and White Kent. I'm, you know, just the colour I am. I don't know any different, so I can't say what's different, but I don't know any different. But you know,
did you feel like you stood out? Is it?
But I always changed it around, you know.
Yeah,
because, you know, I was brown girl in the ring when they're singing Boney M, you know, and I'm just going singing like, yeah, she looks like a sugar in the plum, 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 you know, I'm thinking, yeah. And I always had that attitude that, okay, I'm different, but I'll be unique then. Okay, so if I stand out, then show. So that almost stopped any sort of barriers that maybe I could have had, where I could have had a problem of colour or race or whatever. But I never had a problem, because I always flipped it around and go, well, great, I'm glad I'm different.
Did other people have a problem? Did anyone else?
Not when I was at school, no. I don't feel like I had anyone, because I was quite sort of, with my friends, I've always been a polite, caring person. I've started charity when I was really young. My first big job was actually 16 as a nursing assistant for people with mental health problems back then.
Wow, you know, so you were aware of it?
Yeah, I was aware of people, but I was more aware of people that need help. Mm. I'm always aware of people that need either opportunity to change or help to move forward in life. And I've always been quite astute to that from a very young age. So when I was younger, not knowing my identity, it was my PE teacher telling me I could be good at something that I held on to, which was the running. So then when I'm doing well, it's like everyone then wants to be your team and whatever. And almost it was my outlet to go, this is making me feel good. You know, we were working class family with everyone else, didn't have pocket money. You go out and get it. You go and wash windows, you clean cars, you go shopping for old people because you're going to earn it. And I was always like, earn respect, you know, and then you'll get respect. And I've gone through those attitudes in life, but it is through those sort of tough times that, not so tough, but, you know, I remember being in the child home, of course I do. I know that I didn't have my dad, of course I do. I know that I was different to other people, but you just fight through those and maybe they make you who you are.
Because certainly, well, I've seen you and heard you talk and seen your social media posts about losing your mum and how what a massive void that's left in your life.
Yeah.
How did you kind of reconnect with her? Because obviously you were only, I say only, but you were in a home for a limited amount of time. Yeah. But it was a significant window in your life, wasn't it? Because, you know, I know, well, they say you learn more in the first couple of years of your life than any of the rest of the time put together, but that's the kind of formative years, isn't it?
Yeah, since a baby till sort of five on and off.
Right.
I think I, because, well, you mentioned about, you know, do things affect you as you go on? Of course they do, because you always have that thing about separation or not knowing who you can trust or someone going to leave you before they leave you. It's all of that. And I think that's definitely been a part of my life where I've grown up doing that, but I don't really, you know, don't really talk about those sort of things anyway, but they're definitely things in your life that you can always reflect back on and know why you have those emotions or why you deal with things in a certain way, you know. And yeah, there's a lot that went on between me and my mum, and she was only young, you know, she's 17 when she had me. And you have to remember, you know, I think to myself, God, when I was 34, if I'd had a 17-year-old, but I was 34, I'd do my own, you know, I was winning medals, luckily. But now when I go through my life, not being funny, I just think, oh my God, you know, because I still want to be a child. I still want to be myself, you know, selfish. And I'm thinking to myself, there's my mum there that was just being a young, you know, 20s, 30s, having a child. She was a kid. Mm. So the things that I maybe saw her do and things that maybe battered in my head a little bit as I was growing up as a teenager and leaving my stepdad, all those things definitely affected my life. But that's because she was young doing those things, but I was older, closer, you know, as you're 17 as well, you know, when she left home originally. That was so hard, you know, because again, you just feel like, I always felt that she was the only person that was real in my life because she was my mum, my biological mum. And, you know, I had two white brothers, and but for my dad and my mum. But I always felt like, she's my mum. She's the only thing that I've actually got as whole. Mm. So when we went through ups and downs, but then you do, I was a teenager, you know, I went into the army, you know, her life became her life, my life became my life. But then you reconnect, and then as you get older, and then I started looking after my mum and, you know, put her into a bungalow because of where she lived was bad. And you start to then reconnect, and everything, I did everything, really, to get my mum to have a better life. You know, she just worked as a nurse and assistant at a hospital. I get shit money, you know what I mean? Get nothing. So I was always felt like I needed to be the supporter because, you know, we're not a family where your mum and dad are going to provide for you when they've gone. It's like, no, it's almost the opposite way around. So when I lost her, yeah, it's the worst day of my life.
Really?
Regardless of any thing that I've done to myself, any mental health problems I go through, have gone through, I thought I was going to die myself that day. It's the worst thing.
Yeah.
I just couldn't cope. I couldn't cope with never seeing her again. Not just like, you know, it's just awful.
I can imagine. I can't imagine. I mean, I'm incredibly close to my mum as well. It feels like you've had, your relationship with her has taken lots of different forms. You know, it's been changing the dynamic between it. You know, I've heard you speak about her and how brave she was as a 17-year-old because, bloody hell, I mean, that must have been...
Well, she was told she wasn't allowed to have me. You know,
she was by her own by her,
yeah, she was told she couldn't have me until she sorted her life out. So that's why she put me in the care home. And it was only in Tunbridge Wells, up not far away from here. And she used to have to come and get me. So then I remember the detachment thing, because you always cry. I just remember like screaming when she used to leave me. And having you know, when you just like little things from your life, doesn't matter how old you are, does it? There's little things from when you're a child, it just always resonate, you know. But that. But if you can imagine for her then, being told she can't have you. And then she was told she had to sign adoption papers.
Oh, my God.
I know. And she came to, like, the adoption people came on this day. Because we had to sit down and talk about it, because I was writing my book. And she didn't want to talk about it, but I just said, just tell me. And she said, like, the adoption people came. And they literally went to take me away. And she just screamed and said, no, you ain't taking her away. And left me there. So I feel like, how brave is she? You know what I mean? Could have been a whole new ball game, couldn't it? I could have been anywhere. So I feel like privileged to have had her as my mum, as well as have her strength. We're so different in character, but in one sense, not, because we both have a strength of character. You know what I mean? So I feel like, so when she actually died, it's almost like those, God, we've been through so much. As she was in a mother and baby unit, I remember being at the first flat we were at, you know, and everyone's screaming, coming up, knocking on the door, because I'm like a kid making a noise. And you just think like, all those things that she would have gone through, yet she kept hold of me, but it's in your head, isn't it? So I know I have detachment. I know I have attachment problems, like with relationships. I can never commit, because I'm just like, well, but you might leave.
God,
and it doesn't matter how old you are.
No, 100%.
So never... The day she died, I thought, oh, my God.
So did you feel angry towards her? Like, did you feel... Because however brave she is... Yeah. She's still your mum, you're still her baby, you know? Like, you just think, you just want her to fight for you every step of the way. Do you feel like you've processed those feelings before she died? Were you able to do that?
Yeah, because I think you kind of got... as you get older, you sort of just start to understand things more, don't you? And I don't feel like I've had any bad... upbringing at all, you know, really, compared to the kids that I work with in my charities and stuff. No, I've had nothing. But I always say to people, don't think that your life is not as bad as someone else, because you live your life. So I have to live my life and go, do you know what, that affected me when I was older, then that affected my identity, then it affected whether I felt safe, or then it affected all the other things. But then when I think she died, it was more that history thing, you know what I mean? I've had history with someone for all that time. You know, I know people that have kids at 14. I mean, Jesus, how that attachment goes, I don't know. But like at 17, it's your only constant and your kid, you know. So you go through, and then that's like, oh, well, you know, you know, where are they gone, sort of thing, you know. It's kind of, and also over the years, because of the ups and highs and lows, I felt more like I was always, I feel like, if I reflect, I feel like why I always tried to want to make her life a bit better is because of what she did for me at things. I felt like I was obliged to do it almost. I wouldn't ever say that to her, and she didn't say it, but because she didn't really have a lot, and she never really did a lot during her career. She went to a diamond factory when she had to leave when she had me, so she's just done jobs, you know, cleaning here and there, so never really had the ability to do it, have a bigger career. So then I felt almost like, well, maybe my job, why I'm being successful, is actually then repaying back.
So do you think that did spur you on? Did that motivate you to train harder, to keep succeeding?
Not really, not necessarily for my mum's life, because obviously she was married to Mick, and then, you know, life. So not really in that. Yeah, I don't think it was ever that until later in life. She's been on her own for years, so later in life, and later in her life, definitely.
Because she broke up with Mick.
Yeah, so she left Mick, my stepdad, then went with another guy, had my other sister. Right. That was the bad period of time. That's when I joined the army. We didn't speak or anything. So that was a hard time in life.
How long did you not speak for?
Quite a while. Actually, because I joined the army.
So you were like 18 then?
Yeah, I joined just before I was 18. I don't know when I saw her. I joined her, she came to my pass-out parade, but just wasn't good. She changed a lot with this guy. You know when you see someone change? He'd got done for drugs and stuff, and I think, and I didn't really think, but you know when you see someone change, and like, uh-uh. And I was still young, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it broke my heart. She came looking how she looked and not really cared and didn't come Mick. And that was like the start of that kind of heartache sort of thing, I think, because you kind of feel like you've gone through all of this and then she's ruined that family thing and then she doesn't care. It's all like that sort of thing. But I think when you're younger, you take those things. That's why I see a lot of kids at work in our we look after in our charity from disadvantaged areas, and they're so messed up because of their family makeup, you know what I mean? That detachment or insecurity, or just feel like who's going to look after them for their life, or their hatred of someone because of the fact that they can't trust them anymore or don't look. I just see it, and I can resonate with that, because I remember hating my mum at that time because I felt like she just let everyone down, or you know, she didn't care.
And she's kind of all you had at that point. Did you feel like...
Yeah, I mean, no, I had my stepdad Mick. I mean, geez, I love him to bits, you know what I mean? Yeah. But it's just like, you just think, you know, how can you leave?
Like, but he brothers wasn't your blood. It's that. Maybe different. I don't know.
Yeah, it was. I think then it was, not now, no way. You know what I mean? As life goes on, you know. So, but when you're a kid, you're still a teenager. And back then, not being funny, a child was a child. Mm. I was a young... I had child's head, you know what I mean? I was just a young girl.
You're quite trying to work it all out. I mean, we still are now,
wasn't really
but
confident.
Then...
Yeah, I wasn't really confident in my ability. The army was something that gave me my confidence, really. Mm. So you just go through those and you process those in a different way, don't you? And then as life goes on and different things, and then obviously my mum got ill and I just remember her crying, saying she's too young.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, that was the worst time. And she's crying, so she's too young to die. It's like, oh my God. That was horrible.
I'm sorry. Don't let a glass of water or stop a second. Stop?
No, it's okay. Yeah, so that was the worst time. And then you just think, shit, you can't do nothing about it. What can do? Because hers was incurable, so just treat it.
Blood cancer.
She had myeloma, cancer of the blood and bone. Oh. Didn't know where it's come from, just came out of the blue, so as anyone's concerned. And then you go through, don't you? And then you go through a different emotion, like you do, because no one talks. And this is why I'm so privileged to stand on stage, because I talk about all different sides of me. You know, not everything, but I talk about a lot of things that I know people will resonate in that audience. And then bereavement. No one talks about bereavement. No one talks about it, but it's so hard. Bereavement is horrible.
We all have to experience it at some point.
And it's so like damn hard, isn't it? Yeah. Because people, like, I see people that go back to work after 2 weeks. You're not better back after 2 weeks. You're not better. I have to say, it's taken 18 months I was freaking in bereavement. Literally, I cried every single day until her funeral, 3 weeks. I couldn't come out. I had the cafe at the time. Didn't want to come here in case someone asked, how's my mum? Because she grew up here as well. How's my mum? Sorry to hear about my mum. Or can I have an autograph? You know what I mean? I was just like, I can't go out. So I stayed in. I just couldn't. And I was in a wreck. And that's the first time I really started to know the concept and the value of talking as a mental health form of helping people with mental health, is talking, communicating, because my friends and my family were so upset when I read in my autobiography that I'd gone through all my mental health problems, because I never told them, didn't know how to, And I thought, I'm going to just say it and it's just going to come out, and then what can I do about it? And they were so upset, but not angry with me, upset that they couldn't be there to help me. And I always promised them whenever I needed them, as I have done over the years, that I would come. And at that point, I was like, oh, and they just like stayed, came, and that was it. And, you know, because that took me on a back foot, back with my mental health. The day she died, I cut myself again. And then it was like, then I realised, like, that's not going to help. So I feel like the journey, I stand on stage and I feel like actually my destiny wasn't to win medals. It was to stand on stage and help other people. Really? Talking about, yeah, I don't actually think my destiny was to win those. I think that was the outcome of actually what I'm most powerful for now. Yeah. Because I can talk on stage and I know that I can say to people that struggle shouldn't define you. Life is shit and can be good. Mm. To remember the good times when you're going through the bad times, because you can pat yourself on and pat yourself on the back when you've done something well. And like, everyone's journey is there for a reason, and you can either take up opportunities or not, or to reflect on things that have happened. And I just reflect on all of the highs and lows through life to be strength of character. You know, I did win my gold medals and never gave up. I now stand on stage and I can speak authentically about life, different sides of it, and not be afraid to share. Mm. And when were we ever in a time like that? So, you know, we're in a good place, I think.
And it's getting better. We're not there yet, but I feel so much better. And honestly, I can hear it in your voice. Mm. When I listen and where I read things from 10 years ago, even listening to you do Desert Island Discs.
Oh my God, how many years ago is that?
That's a long time ago. Up until now, you sound a different person. It's like you've gone on this journey with the people you're helping, who've in turn helped you, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But I mean, I still sense you're holding some back, and I don't blame you for it. It's like deeply personal, and you've got to sort of like gradually open that up and decide what you're comfortable talking about and what you're not.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that every little baby step you've taken, actually, you've come a very long way.
I've had to come a long way, because, you know, when you're in the army, it's a different thing, different rules, regulations. And then, you know, I've had periods of time where you question a lot about different things about yourself anyway, but, you know, when you're a private person, as I am anyway, you choose what you want to say and what you don't want to say, because that's the life you end up living, because that's the life you always you live. And I remember being in the army, because armies, so they're just like soldiers, just say it as it is anyway, you know what I mean? And I remember one of my best mates, Jason, and he came and he was mixed race. And he's, I think it doesn't, it's really irrelevant, but he's, I think his mum was black and his dad was white, so the opposite way around. He was my mate, came in, blah blah blah, and the guy said, is it your brother? And I went, and I actually hadn't grown up with any mixed race people. All my brothers were white, but at the time. And I just looked at him, I said, you ignorant twat. I said, just because he's got the same fucking colour skin as me, you think he's my brother? Are you actually that shallow?
Because you wouldn't say that to two white people, just because they both happen to be white.
I know. And I went, no, actually my brothers are white.
Yeah.
I said, so, and then I said, do you know what? And then I said that day, I'm always going to have, you can assume, I don't care what people assume, but it's my choice to tell you, because you're going to assume anyway. Mm. And I always lived my life going with that whole bit of, I don't need to tell you about my personal life or what I am or what I do in life, because the assumption of people are always there. And I remember that day saying to that guy, I said, you know what? You've just given me the reason to never have to say anything about myself again. I said, because you've just really ticked off the boxes of prejudice or not prejudice, but kind of
stereotyping and assuming,
assuming, kind of whatever.
And yeah, like, but that shouldn't close you up. I think, I know, if anything, you should combat that by your. Yeah. Now, I'm not saying you don't have to ever lay yourself bare.
No.
Like, it's a totally personal thing how much you share or don't share.
Yeah.
And there's certainly things that I would never feel comfortable to say that now. I might do. Right, do you know what I mean? I definitely feel different now. I'm a mum.
Yeah.
I feel completely different.
You?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a lovely way.
Yeah.
I feel vulnerable in a way that I didn't feel before. But
oh,
I feel much stronger in a way that I didn't feel before. I just feel different.
Yes.
I feel that you're the winning of your medals was so significant because it gave you the platform to talk to people. Mm-hmm. It gave you the voice.
Yeah.
It's given you exposure and profile, and people want to listen. They want to hear how you overcame all of that to be so successful and to be a hero to so many people.
Yeah. And that's what I like. I like the fact that I can talk about a journey in an authentic and real world to make a difference to maybe people's struggles, you know what I mean? Because everyone's so different, everyone's life's so different, everyone, how they feel, they think, and what they do in their life, and everyone can do what they want. And people have a choice to say and don't say what they want as well. But I think when it comes to struggling or going through kind of just, either whether it's career or background or life journeys, I know I can speak authentically.
By the way, people know straight away if you're not. People spot a bullshitter a mile off.
Yeah, always.
So if you're authentic and, you know, I'm looking in the eyes now and you are, you're just, this is, you know, it's all real and it all matters and it impacts me and it'll impact the listeners. And, you know, that's this incredible kind of passing it forward positivity, which I think you're talking about.
Yes.
Did your mum die were there any regrets? Was there anything left unsaid? Is there any more you would have done in your development of your relationship with your mum?
No, I think we were at a really good place anyway. And it was more, I was always supporting her, if you know what I mean. Mm. But no, I don't think there's nothing left unsaid, other than you can always say to someone you love them more, can't you? Mm. You know, and that's the thing.
She'd have known though, wouldn't she?
Yeah, and what, I mean, a laugh inside of it is that we'd also been to, unfortunately, three other funerals that year, earlier in the year, and then the last one, she's like, we're sitting at the back because we turned up a bit late and we were laughing. And pretty much planned her whole funeral at this other funeral because she was going, if you put me in one of those bloody boxes, I'm coming back to Hortney. I want a wicker basket. She always, like, quite strong-minded, like, what she wanted. I was like, geez. So I sat down for her one day and I said, like, you know, what do you want, what things, all this, this. And I loved the fact
that,
what she's going to do and how she wasn't going to be, you know, she wanted to be scattered and all these sort of stuff. And we had a bit of fun as a family. It brought us closer together as a family. We were close anyway, but, you know, you have those moments where you meet up. And no, I just feel like, you know, I think she was more happy. She was a mum, happy person, as in that was her life, you know what I mean? Her grandchildren. I think she got past. She wasn't driven like me. Mm. You know, I used to say, you're my mother, because, like, we were so different in terms of our ambitions. And maybe she just had it when she was young and then gave up on them because she had children, you know. Yeah. She had three children by whatever.
But she had her 20s. Own battles, you know, being a 17-year-old mum.
Yeah, well, she's
baby.
Gone all through that. And I don't know if, you know, people are different characters, aren't they? Yeah. You know, and so I feel like we have the same strength of character in a way that, you know, quite dogged and go.
Yeah.
But she was definitely not ambitious like me. She's always like, slow down, you know, kind of what you do, you know, why? You know, because I'm like, you know, into a running and in the army. We had no connection there. There was no commonality there. She hated sport, hated fitness, had no connection with the army. We were so polar opposites in that sense. But the biggest things I think I miss from it is that I'd call her every day, text her every day, send her photos, videos. I know she didn't like something I'd wear because she wouldn't say, oh, you look great. And, you know what I mean? I'd know straight away, and I'd always want confirmation from her. I'd say, oh, what do you think of the interview? Because I'd know she would say, oh, it was all right. Or she would criticise the person that was interviewing me, or she'd say something, you know what I mean? And I can't do that. And that's one thing I really miss, that, you know, where I get so excited. I've done so much now, even since she died, like, just slowed, you know, when I was made the colonel with the Royal Armoured Corps, you know, she would just been like over the moon and just thought, oh my God, you know, and all the things I do and I stand on stage now, I would have loved to have seen a stage. But then in the same sense, since she's died, the way I talk on stage is very different. I have to say, like, the last 18 months, my speaking engagements have just, like, exploded. And I feel I'm very different at presenting on stage. You know, I give a lot of myself and I really try and engage with the audience. And a lot of that has also come from how I've coped and dealt with and been more confident in myself since my mum's died, because I feel like you only live once, obviously. You get to a point where you kind of can get a little bit more comfortable with yourself. But I think that takes time.
you'd be at one with yourself, yeah. Love yourself, accept yourself. That's really.
But I think some things take time to come. Those, you know, I've always been kind of a. I wasn't that confident as a young child, so even though you do your athletics and stuff, still me. I'm doing it as an individual. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But actually, to put yourself out there in front of people, it's quite hard when you've always been.
Yeah.
A closed
a bit
book.
Shy, yeah.
Yeah, if you've always been a closed book, you can't just suddenly just become an open book.
Mm.
So my gradual opening is actually being more honest with myself around my struggles, because that's helped me open up partly about who I am, I suppose.
Mm.
So you get to a place where you're a little bit more comfortable to do it, and you don't want people to judge you, so you end up thinking, shall I, shan't I? It's all those different things that you...
But you know, every person that you might think judges you, actually, I think, helping at least 10 more.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because that honesty is so empowering, not only to yourself, but to others. And that in itself is such a motivating factor, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of things that you could say could really make a difference to people's lives.
What a gift.
But you have to choose what ones you do and don't.
Yeah, but I mean, definitely. And again, it's a personal thing, but massive gift for someone like you. Do you feel that someone, or maybe a combination of people, have filled the void that your mum's left? Do you feel like you've got that support network? Do you feel supported?
Yeah, my friends and family are brilliant anyway.
Yeah.
And I've made, so again, like over the last couple of years, I was always sort of, it was always just my tight-knit group. I've had friends from day one at school, and you know, since I was four, always been just the same. They were who I trust 100%. I think now I've started to realise I can trust other people that I start to connect with, and whether it's in business or whatever. So I've made friends who know a lot more about me, who I'd never ever share or say anything with. It would literally be like, we go for a meal, that's it, you ain't getting nothing from me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now I've got a real, you know, just through meeting people, I've just got to know, and I feel comfortable with somebody, and you can feel, I feel like I have a good intuition with people now. I know who I could trust, and it's not going to come back to hurt me or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's made me feel more freer and happier in my life, because now I can just, you know, have friends that it's all right, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter what I say to them, they don't care. But when you've always had half of you that felt like if you say stuff you'll be judged, or what will people think, or people going to look at you a different way, or people whatever, you just don't say anything. It's just easier not to. It's easier not to say things in people's life than to actually think of the worry of saying things. So now I get to a point where I can say things to certain people, it's like, oh.
So you're just discerning about who you open up to,
or...
Yeah, this is such an interesting mix, because you can still stand up on stage and talk to a kind of almost not anonymous crowd, but you don't necessarily know everybody in it.
No, I don't know anyone.
You, don't,
you know, I did one recently, 1,700 people on stage at a thing, and I got 2 standing ovations. I was literally crying on stage because I was just like, wow. Because in sport, you have that bit where it's black and white in sport, So in life, it's quite subjective. It's somebody else's opinion of you, isn't it? It's somebody else telling you whether you're good or you're not good. And when you've been a sporting high achiever, you kind of want to know if you are or you aren't. And then you've got nothing to judge it against. And then when I got this, like 1,700 people, literally it was like, I felt like this pop star. And I just almost got confirmation of the route I'm taking in life is the right route.
Yeah.
Because I know that if I can empower people, motivate, inspire, but also give some people a sense of belonging, identity, feel like they can achieve, and even if when they feel like they can't, all those little bits that I take from my life, if I can just know that I've just given someone some hope, then I love it. I absolutely love it.
Well, the fact that you're able to be as honest as you are about the depths that you that you went to with self-harming, and then the highs of like standing on the top of the rostrum, but also I think in many ways that the standing in front of those 1,700 people with a standing ovation is in itself almost a bigger achievement, because that is you laying yourself bare.
Yeah.
Can you make sense when you look back at the self-harming now? Do you understand what you were trying to do in that moment? Have you thought about it? Have you discussed it? Have you had therapy for it?
No, although I do say to people, maybe they need therapy, and I'm like, I better open up too many cans worth. You know, I always have this one, it's so weird, like my life is sort of this, it's evolved as it does, you know, but when you've gone from a shy kid to a closed book to a more open thing to achieve it, it all mixes up a little bit, and you kind of get to a point where you're like, what do, and where am I at? And, you know, I still question myself a bit as like, why don't I do this? Why don't I do that? I still question myself, and I suppose I will over time. And, you know, when you want to, you know, when whatever, but like when some people says to me, oh, have you gone to therapy? I'm like, yeah, but they dive too close, too into you. And I'm like, but I don't know them. Yeah, I can stand on stage and speak, because there's always, I feel like on stage, there's a separation. There's always a separation. I can give them everything I need to give them and want to give them.
You control
it. I don't
it.
Have to give them anything I don't want
That's
to.
That's interesting.
Yeah? So I can give every part of everything to the point where you don't need to know that.
And then you say, okay, this is where I draw the line. I don't feel comfortable beyond that.
Yeah, just don't
it's
talk
interesting.
About it.
I won't say their name, but there's someone very close to me who I think really needs therapy. Mm. And he, she, I won't even identify their sex because it's not fair. This is their journey. Feels like they're such a web. They are so tangled that where do I even start? Like, and they are scared, a bit like this can of worms that you talk about, that once they even take the lid off a tiny bit, it's just going to be a mess. But my argument to them is, unless you start, you're never going to know. And I don't want them to die.
No.
Having never unraveled what is an incredibly complex childhood for them, you know, a lot of abuse, a lot of heartache and all the rest of it. And
I think people should.
I have a heavy heart.
I advocate
that people talk.
I always advocate. And I do think there's
a
lot of people that need it.
You've become a much better communicator over the years, don't you think? Like, not just talking to people, but you know.
Yeah, just be more chatty with people. Yeah, I mean, I even go to events and I used to I don't know why. You know, you go to places and you just feel like shy or nervous to speak to people.
Human on the track doesn't mean that
it's just very weird, isn't it?
And it's a strength. Yeah, you know, it is a strength. Do you know one thing I thought was quite interesting that you talked about when your mum died, you shaved that bit of your head, which by the way, I think is wicked. It looks lush. I love it. But why do you think that was? Why did it need, there need to be a sort of physical representation almost of that shift in your life? Because I know a lot of people talk about when they have a big breakup, they cut all their hair off, they do something quite dramatic. Why do you think you did that?
I think it was more about, I felt like sometimes you can conform a little bit. Sometimes you can feel like you're conforming to society generally. Mm. So you know, come back from the Olympic Games and you kind of go to all these events and everyone's dressed up and they're in their long dresses and their whatever and long hair, and you just felt like you have to blend in or fit in, you know what I mean? And then I just thought to myself, I'll sod this. I can't be bothered anymore. Because I thought, well, she didn't get a chance to do it. It was almost like that. I'd been talking about it and I kept saying to the hairdresser down the road, I kept saying, oh, I feel like I just need to just do something, you know? And it was all just chit-chat. And the morning of my mum's funeral, I was like, take it bloody off. Really? And I turned up and I felt, from that moment, I felt like I'm more me now, how I dress, what I look like, what I do, because I feel more, that's what I want.
But did you feel like you could be more you because your mum had passed?
No, just because it gave you that thing of life's too short.
Right, okay.
Life's so short, you never know what's around the corner. So I thought, no, sod it. So now I wear what I want when I go to an event. You know, everyone's
in
their
quite
long...
freeing? Is it quite liberating?
It. Yeah. You know, I went to one on Saturday, everyone's in their long thingy dresses, and I've got like a, you know, a tuxedo dress on.
Nice.
With my big glitzy boots on and all my earrings. I was like, yeah. And everyone's like, oh my God, you look really cool. And I thought, yeah, because I want to go back to what I used to think about standing out is unique, and actually, why not be different? Why be the same as everyone
else? Girl in the ring.
Right?
Sha-la-la-la-la. By the way, that is one of my favourites. I couldn't believe that song. My dad had a jukebox, and we had a little button, and my brother and I worked out a way of not having to put money into this jukebox, but we could just push a button really hard. Yeah. And we always chose Brown Girl in the Ring.
Did you?
I don't know why. I just love that song.
It was just a great song, isn't it?
It is a good song.
So, so that's it.
Okay, so that's like, interesting. Yeah. But you've definitely got, I think, the image of someone that's like a little bit edgy, and that's cool, and that's engaging, and bloody hell, why blend in?
So that's what I felt. And again, I think age just gives you that.
Yeah.
The only thing, because I hate aging process. I hate aging. Everyone keeps saying, you're lying.
Why do you hate it so much?
I feel like I've got too much to do.
Right.
I feel like it's just not a nice natural process.
No, no, I mean, I don't like women, do they? No. But by the way, you look incredible.
Oh no, oh my God, no, I'm literally to the point where I'm just like, come on. No, I can't cope with this anymore.
So give me some quick bullet points. What's left to do? That you feel
business woman of the year for something.
Nice.
Yeah, stand on stage being saying I've done this.
Amazing. That's definitely achievable.
Yep, I'd like to be known as a global inspirational speaker. So that's
already,
my aim to go up there. But there, I do speak abroad, but it's companies who are abroad get me over. As opposed to I want overseas to say, oh my God, this is the person to have for sort of leadership, fitness, and inspiration. So that'd be my aim. Yeah.
Well, that's happening.
Those two things are happening. Those two things.
One thing that you don't talk about very much at all is love. I mean, you've touched on it that you don't want to let anybody in. Mm-hmm. Is there room for love in your life?
Oh, I can't tell you.
No. Just don't feel comfortable going there.
No.
That's a shame, isn't it?
Oh.
Feels like you've got a lot of love to give.
One day.
Yeah? Do you think?
Who knows? No, it's not like I haven't seen people. It's just that you just kind of make your decisions on what you want and don't want, isn't it? It's not like I've lived a life of...
No, not a nun.
No, definitely not a nun.
Pleased to hear that.
I was in the army, remember?
Yeah, that's very true. But what about being a mum? Would you ever want to be a mum?
No, too old.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. I'm ancient.
Stop.
Yes, I am. I'm a mum at my age.
Bridget Nielsen, actually.
No, how old is she?
She's definitely older than you, a lot.
Yeah, but how old was she when
I'm
going to
Google it. She had a kid in June.
What?
Yes. I swear
to
God.
Grandma.
I'm Googling it right now.
Never.
Bridget Nielsen, age when she became a mum.
No
guarantee
chance.
I've got
nine nieces and nephews. Okay. I love them. They come over to my house. I give them all of the love and thingy, and then I wave them goodbye and say, love you lots. Bye.
And you don't look as knackered as me as a result.
Exactly that. I'm too selfish. I've got things I want to do in my own life. I feel like, where are you going to fit in?
I tell you what, it is funny because I look back at those, I've said this to a few people, hang on, Bridget Nielsen, mum. How old was Bridget Nielsen when she had her last child?
Oh, God.
She was 54.
Oh, my word. No.
In June.
Mad.
There you go.
Mad woman.
She looks amazing. Yeah, but I've said this before. I look back at, you only get those Facebook memory things that pop back up.
Yeah.
And I see ones from just 5 years ago, and I go,
fucking
hell, I cannot believe how much younger I looked then, pre-kids.
Yeah.
It's just this constant drip-drip thing of sleep deprivation. Like, last night, I told you, did the Autosport Awards, came home, was up at 6 with the kids, so came home, got bed at 2, up at 6. You cannot sustain that.
No.
Like, I mean, certainly without aging at least a decade in the process.
Exactly. So I don't like that aging process at all. Anyone that says... they're lying. The only thing I do like is the ability to know yourself a bit more, be a bit more confident. Mm. You grow with that, and you know, most time for most things, I'm like, I don't give a shit.
Good.
You know, you get to the thing, I don't care.
Good. So, what advice would you give to your younger self then?
With
the wisdom that you have gathered and are continuing to gather, I feel it's.
Yes, continuing, definitely continuing. I don't think I'd really... I was asked to write a letter to my younger self once. Like, what would I write as a letter to myself? And I actually turned it around and actually said, like, well done.
Good.
For everything you've done. Yeah. Because I think some people, you always assume you should have been something different or led a different thing, but I don't think I should have. I feel like everything I did was for a reason and learning, you know.
And by the way, you couldn't control the bad stuff that was happening to you. It's how you dealt with it that matters.
But at school, you know, when you're the kid sitting outside the classroom all the time because, you know, what they're teaching you is just... like a foreign language, which it was when it's French, but you know,
it's
important. Yeah. Like, what? You've got a bit of attitude because they're coming back to you, blah, 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 blah. I have no idea what you're telling me.
Did they identify in you the strengths that you clearly have? Was there any one teacher?
Yeah, my PE teacher.
Really?
Yeah, she told me.
There's always one,
get
isn't
a grip.
There?
Yeah, she actually told me to get a grip because I was getting bad sort of reports from the other teachers and said that I could be a really good runner, but you have to concentrate on that. So, got my mum to take me down to the local athletics club down Tunbridge, just down the road, and told me not to give them that one because I tried tried all these other things and give up after like about a week. My dad's there, he'd probably know, wouldn't your dad?
Is that your dad there?
Yeah. So, well, he gave up on everything. Sue Athletics. Don't say a lot. gave up on, went into athletics because, again, that was an identity thing. You know, when all your friends are perceived in your eyes to be rainy and get it all, when you're like that, thinking, getting ungraded for your exam results and all that, you kind of have to have hope on something, don't you?
So what would you say to other kids potentially listening to this about, you know, that might be lacking a sense of direction at this stage? Because it definitely comes to people at different stages of their life, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel really so lucky to, at 14, have known, had two dreams, to be in the Army's physical training instructor and to be Olympic champion.
Very clear vision.
Very clear, very clear. I knew when I went home after watching the Olympics, that's where I went to school, after watching the Olympics, and I said to Kerry, Lara and Kim, who are my best friends, I am going to be Olympic champion. They said, yes, you probably are, because the only bloody thing you're good at, which was their words, they're still my best friends to this day, but I knew it. I don't know why. And then the Army, when they came, the careers officers came in and they showed us the Navy and the Air Force and the Army, I knew that day I was going to be in the Army. And I remember getting my mum to take me to the careers office like when I was 15 and 16 and 17, and they kept saying, you're too young, because back then you could only be 17 and 9 months. Anyway, then I joined. So what I would say to young people is that, you know, we all have a passion. For some it's too early to know where your destiny's going, but a lot of us have a passion that we enjoy things, and you should look at yourself and go, well, what is it I really enjoy? And then try and manipulate that pathway.
You're right. Weird little machine's done something funny then. I don't know what's going on.
We've run out of...
No, I don't think so. That's really weird. Finally from me, I just want to know your... Well, two things, actually. One, what keeps you awake at night now? When you're lying in bed, what do you think about? Because everybody has something different.
Yeah.
What is your next little challenge? The here and now, what are you working on?
Working on creating a online app for corporate health and wellbeing.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so it's going to cover mental health awareness in the workplace, mindset, fitness, motivation and nutrition. So it's a tool for organisations to be able to get to all their employees and make a difference to their wellbeing. So I'm working on that at the moment with a couple of guys, the little IT company we've got. So obviously I'm made a colonel in the Royal Armoured Corps, so I get to wear my greens and still go in.
Nice.
Yeah, get one saluting me. in a tank. I've just worked out that I'm the only Colonel Dame in the world, so that's cool.
That is really cool. Bloody hell. Along with Bose, In the Pink is sponsored by Tag Heuer, Swiss avant-garde since 1860. Excellence, precision and elegance. Their timepieces are designed for those who love challenges, which is a great fit for this podcast because most of the guests share that sentiment. Finally, I want to know your take on the current crop of athletes and who really excites you. Dina Asher-Smith's obviously up for Sports Personality of the Year, which is amazing.
Yes.
And where you think British athletes are in the whole scheme of things at the moment. Are we in a good place?
I think athletics as a sport is in a bad place. I think we in as a country have got some great young talent coming through. As you say, Dean Asher-Smith and KGT, who won the heptathlon world champs. I think they are brilliant. What I love about Dina is she has everything. She's beautiful inside and out. She's got a great personality. She looks really good. She's really powerful, but she's like a woman with purpose. You know, she's out there to be the best in the world, which for young people gives a role model of work hard, don't give up on your dream, keep trying, but you can still look good, you know. So I love that. There's another girl called Laura Muir, who's distance runner.
Yeah.
Jesus, she's like world best. Can you imagine, though, losing the world championships or not even getting a medal when they're running, like, she ran 3:56 after having an injury. I mean, she's like literally world-class athlete. So her time's yet to come, but she's always up against the Kenyans, isn't she, and Ethiopians. So I think the sport's gone through changes because since obviously, Mo's apparently coming back next year in the 10,000 metres, I think. But, you know, when we had eras, haven't we, of generations of British athletes that you could put your hat on. We said about the Coes and Ovetts and the Crammy years, and then you had the Linford Christie, Sally Gunnell, Colin Jackson, Steve Backley years, and then you might have
Roger Black.
And then me and Paula Radcliffe and Denise Lewis years, and then it kind of goes through cycles.
It's
and
cyclical, you had
Jess Ennis and Craig and Greg Rutherford and Mo. You just need that next era, but we need stars. That isn't just about performance. They've got to project themselves well. They've got to interact with people. They've got to be a people's person. Mm. I think that's what people are looking for. So I really hope, who knows what Tokyo is going to bring, but I know, what a great games. I need a job at Tokyo. Someone please give me a job at Tokyo.
And we will end this podcast with an advert for Dame Kelly Holmes and a position at Tokyo. Thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you. Wow. So, yes, thank you, Kelly. That was really very moving indeed. It's so interesting, isn't it, when you see someone who's physically so strong and has so much success to their name and such a beaming smile and such a lovely energy, you don't really begin to consider that they may be having real struggles behind the scenes. So, Kelly, thank you for your honesty. I know that you will have helped a lot of people by talking so openly. I loved our time together chatting and could have gone on and on. So thank you so much. And thank you also to you listening for your feedback. Again, if you have been affected by anything we talked about, the Samaritan's number is 116 123. You can call them, of course, anytime, day or night. They are always there to listen, 24 hours, 365 days a year. So thank you for your company. Plenty more in the Pink Podcast on the way. Thank you for listening and thank you for your feedback. Continue to rate, review and subscribe. And you could be in for winning some headphones. And actually, Tag Heuer have put some Premier League tickets up for grabs. So stay with us to find out how you can win. For the 2020 year. Oh, I can't believe it's 2020 very soon. My goodness. Anyway, look, in the meantime, very, very Merry Christmas. Stay safe, stay healthy, look after each other. Loads of love, and I will see you in the new year.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.